Namaste and welcome to this new edition of the Bharatvata podcast. Today we have got with us Sanjeev Sanyal, who is the Principal Economic Advisor to the Government of India. Sanjeev, thank you for your time and joining us for Bharatvata today.
Namaskar.
It's really exciting to have Sanjeev to talk about the state of the Indian economy. And in the next few minutes, we will cover his views on where we are headed and the impact of the pandemic on the economic position this financial year and in the coming times. So, Sanjeev, let me start off by asking you, how do you see the Indian economy currently and the shaping of this financial year?
So I think we need to take a quick background because, as you know, the last 1.5 years have been unusual, to say the least. Obviously, we went through a major first wave and a lockdown last year between end of March and into maybe as much as July, and then slowly easing it up through to September. And that caused all kinds of disruptions in the economy. It was a full lockdown. In many ways, we were not prepared for the many intricacies of dealing with the pandemic at that time. And, you know, so that time was what was used up to create at least some quarantining facilities, PPE kits, and all those kinds of things. That was when the vaccination research started. So it was critical time. But as far as the economy is concerned, it was locked down. I mean, we didn't have a choice about doing that lockdown, but we have to recognize there was an economic price to be paid about it. But once we began to open things up, starting around October, we saw two things. One is that the consumer came back quite aggressively, in fact. And importantly, we also saw, you know, a lot of government capital expenditure, which was very sharply ramped up. A lot of government payments were made, so that there's liquidity in the system. And of course, the various measures that were announced from, you know, a large-scale food program, the world's largest, with, you know, food for 800 million people. There were guarantee schemes for credit for the MSMEs and so on. And basically what we found is that what could have been quite a, you know, spiral downwards was more than arrested. And by, you could see that by the January to March quarter, the economy was actually recovering very strongly. Unfortunately, April and May then got hit by the second speed bump, which was quite vicious as far as the health situation was concerned. We had this huge second wave. It was very, very disruptive in multiple ways. Of course, from a health perspective, it was in a completely different level from the first wave in terms of the, you know, number of infections, the number of deaths, and so on. And no doubt, you know, it's now come off very significantly. We are now back to, you know, we are far below even the peak of the first wave. But nevertheless, we have to recognize that this was a major speed bump. The question then is, what are the what is the economic momentum looking like right now, i.e. having had this reacceleration, very strong one, and then going into the disruptions caused by the second wave? Now, first of all, we didn't have a national lockdown. So in that sense, this was not quite in the same level from an economic perspective as disruptive as so on the health front, it was worse. But on the economic front, that was it was not quite as tight a lockdown. In any case, having gone through the first round, people were much more used to what was needed to go through. So that was good. We also had certain parts of the economy actually doing rather strongly because you had, for example, exports gathering momentum because the rest of the world is going through its unlocking as well. You also had a situation where certain parts of the parts of the country were kept open. And so you did have these rolling lockouts across the country, but at different points in time, different parts of the country were functioning reasonably well. So that was good. And there are certain sectors that were doing reasonably well. For example, construction continued to do, in fact, if anything, you know, steel prices and cement prices began to creep up. So there were large parts of the economy that actually continued to function rather well through the second wave and did not lose momentum. That's important to remember. It is also important to remember that there were other parts of the economy that did get affected just as much. For example, hotels, hospitality, restaurants, and so on, they were shut down yet again. And remember, they have gone through this once before. So in that sense, they, you know, cash flows and other things are already impaired, and they have to go through this one more time. So that is on the other side, they were here. But I think if you look at purely from a year-on-year perspective, you'll see the growth rates will be reasonably good. Not as good as what may have been if you didn't have the second round, but the momentum has not been entirely lost. But going, looking forward, what are the pros and cons? Now, on the pros, you have, I think, export looking reasonably good still. So I think that is going to be a good thing. As I said, a lot of the momentum that was there in certain sectors like construction, infrastructure, etc., that remains strong. Since we had already gone through some of the measures needed during the first round, we knew many of the things we needed to do. So, for example, the food program was extended. We extended some of the credit guarantee systems and so on. So some of the sort of cushioning things we needed on the economic front, we already knew what to do and we plus them. On the other hand, now we have gone through a second wave. So there are other things that are different this time as well. First of all, we can't be sure that the middle class will come back and spend again in the same way they did in the past of the first lockdown. For the simplest reason, in the first round, the middle class kind of saw it as a forced holiday. You will remember, people were posting photographs of their cooking, their Delgano coffee and all that kind of thing. I think the second round has been much more closer to home. People have lost near and dear ones. Even those who have not been personally affected will certainly know of somebody who has been personally affected. So in that sense, the mood is much more somber, and it's difficult to tell psychologically what the impact of that will be. There will be an opening up and people will come back to some extent, but to what extent that pent-up demand will follow through, we needs to be watched. We can't predict it. We need to watch this, and there's something we have to be concerned about. Secondly, there is the issue of inflation. Now, prices did spike up the last time as well because of supply side disruptions. But if you remember what I was saying at that time, we were not concerned about inflation substantially last time, because it's quite obvious that demand was not, was not the problem. They had caused a temporary supply side breakdown. That supply side was opened up and inflation did indeed come down. Now what you have is a more complicated picture, because first of all, there is inflation globally coming back. So that is something you need to take into account. Energy prices have spiked up very significantly. So unlike in the first phase where oil prices crashed, here oil prices have actually gone up. And of course, there is the repeated breakdowns of various things that have happened. And we need to see what has happened to the supply side. Is this a permanent scarring of various bits and pieces of the supply side? Or is it the case that this, once we open up, it will all go back? So for the first time in many, many years worldwide, we need to watch inflation. I'm not saying that this is going to go into a spiral just yet. It may well be that it'll all kind of ease things up, maybe Iran oil coming back on stream, etc., will temper things. So I'm not sort of beginning to press the red button yet. But I do think that unlike the first time where I was completely sanguine about the inflation situation, I will in this round watch it quite carefully.
Right. Thanks, Sanjeev. That was very comprehensive in terms of how the picture has evolved between last year and this year. So most of the agencies have reduced the GDP growth forecast, right? They talked about 12-13%, and now the estimates are between 8-11%, depending on which agency are we talking about. So do you see that? Is that a reasonable guess to say that the there'll be a reduction in the GDP growth this year?
So GDP growth rate was in our budget, if you remember, we put a very conservative number of 10.5, which was well below what other people were forecasting. And even in the economic survey, I think it was a little above 11%. So the point is that we already had somewhat more conservative numbers than many of the others. Now, so of course, we will have to watch what happens about the the revival path that we will now see. But I think the government's numbers will not have to be revised quite so much as many of the others, which were much more optimistic than ours. So in that sense, we will probably not need to reduce very much. But yes, it's something we need to watch. I mean, you cannot deny that there was a second wave and it was disruptive.
Right. So, Sanjeev, one data point you spoke about was the trade data. We have seen a 30 billion plus trade since March for 3 months. Even the first week of June was pretty strong at 7.71 billion. I think historically, India has had only had 4 or 5 months of trade ever, which crossed 30 billion. And now we have had 3 months in a row and potentially a fourth month as well. So are things actually turning a corner on trade, or more, this is more like a global pent-up demand and these switches kind of causing this blip?
So there's no question that global demand has come back very strongly. We are benefiting from that, no doubt about it. And also there is the fact that, you know, global supply chains are slowly redeveloping themselves, so to speak, for a new geopolitical environment. And so we have seen many things. For example, the very strong FDI numbers that we have been seeing for quite some time. By the way, the numbers you're speaking about are only the merchandise numbers. Even yes. The services trade has also been very strong. So both services and merchandise trade has been strong. As I said, part of it is because of geopolitical reorientation. There is China plus one and all these kinds of factors. There is the redevelopment, reemergence of global demand, which has come out quite strongly. There is FDI flows, which means that we are slowly but steadily becoming much more integrated in global supply chains, which we were not. So there are multiple factors. The question is, will it be sustained? Now, the global demand reinflation will go on for a little while longer. But of course, very difficult to predict how that will pan out. I think the redistribution and reorientation of global supply chains may be a longer term and more reliable dynamic. And that is there now in the thinking of most global companies. And you saw that even in the G7 communiques and so on. There is now even a new US-led initiative to have a Belt and Road initiative from the US. So you can clearly see the reorientation. And yes, as part of that, we hope to take advantage of it. Obviously, we cannot, it will not happen naturally. We have to actively go out there and participate in it. But we are cognizant of the opportunity. And of course, this is what the PLI scheme is all about. This is, explicitly to take advantage of new emerging systems. The other good thing that we need to take advantage of, and we have to be conscious about doing this, is to take advantage of the fact that we now are finally, thanks to GST, a common market internally. We were never a large common market, and therefore we could never take advantage of global skills or by taking advantage of our home market. We can now do this. And so this is actually an important aspect of the global supply chain that we can now finally take advantage of, and we should take advantage of it. And I think there are other factors as well. For example, we need to be able to both push for open trade, both at the WTO, but also at our own level through making deals with, large markets. Very often people look at our reluctance to join RCEP as some sort of a reluctance to participate in global trading blocks. That is actually wrong. We did not participate in RCEP because it did not work for us. It wasn't in our national interest. It was not an ideological problem with joining trading blocks. We recognize that India's future lies in being a serious participant in global trade and being a participant in global supply chains. It just was that particular trade deal didn't work for us. That does not mean that we will not explore trade deals with other large markets.
Right. It's interesting, Sanjeev, you spoke about PLIs. When we did it last year, there was a lot of commentary on how this is protectionist. But somehow the US itself is now speaking the same language, right? In the last week, President Biden spoke about supply chain rebalancing. So it's good that in some ways, that thought is now a more globally accepted thought and not just limited to India. Sanjeev, you spoke about GST and the internal market. We will soon be completing 4 years of GST, I think, in about 2 weeks from now. So what is the thought process on the evolution of GST? Has it served its purpose? What changes do we need further? How do we make it better?
So what was the purpose of GST? One was to simply create a large internal market. You know, we had an absurd situation in India where it was actually easier for Mumbai to trade with Shanghai than for Mumbai to trade with Delhi. Now, I think that has changed. And I think 4 years later, even its detractors will agree that the system, while it may not be perfect, is certainly a huge improvement on whatever used to exist before. I think that is now widely accepted. There were many glitches along the way. But frankly, the only way to have done it was to do it and then fix the glitches. And I think the system is, yeah, as I said, I'm not claiming that it's perfect, but it's certainly far less glitchy than it ever was before. You know, all the rent seeking and other things that used to happen at every step earlier, that has gone. Many of the misuses of the system initially have also been worked out and taken out. So we have now a workable system, which means that as and when the economy eventually opens up and grows, revenues will certainly become very closely buoyant with it. And we got a taste of that in the April numbers, which were basically for the March transactions. So if the economy grows, this system is capable of picking up the revenue. Now, that is a huge progress, which is basically you have now got a system that is, you know, built-in buoyancy. Now you can focus on just growing the economy and this thing will do the job. Now that doesn't mean we shouldn't fix it. There are all kinds of problems still with it. My own view is that it should be much simpler. We should try and have as many things as possible in one central rate somewhere. And I think that is something we will ultimately have to move towards. And I'm not a big votary that, you know, this whole revenue neutral rate argument. That may be a reasonable and meaningful argument during the transition period. But now we should abandon that and begin to think about what is the most efficient rate. And I think that we need to think in a blue sky way. My guess it would be somewhere in the 15% range. And we should move most things to it. But, you know, at what rate you do it and when you do it is a matter of judgment, whether or not you should be doing it at a time where anyway there are so many things, so many moving parts that maybe it may be worthwhile leaving the current system to chug along for a little while because everybody, at least for now, is used to it. But at some point, we've got to simplify it and have a system where most things run on one. I'm not saying we'll have only one rate. That may not be possible. But certainly the central rate could be the dominant rate on which now, as I said, we may not be able, I would not be in favor of making too many changes right now in the middle of a pandemic and various other things, but this should be our ultimate target.
Right. Yep. So, Sanjeev, we have a situation where a lot of the short-term data looks good. Like GS, for example, I think we have had 8 months of 1 lakh crore plus collections and, of course, growth over the previous period. Exports have been good. Consumption was strong in Q1. But on the other hand, we have had reports of about 200 million people sliding down the poverty line. Several lakhs of businesses getting closed as per various media reports. I mean, the numbers are yet to be kind of fully tallied, but looks like it's a severe impact on a part of the economy. So what is needed to support that vulnerable part, which is not participating or not going to participate as the economy opens up back in the growth story?
So my thing is that first and foremost, you've got to get the economy going and not take your eye off this, the fact that we need growth. I'm not a big votary of this argument that there is some sort of a growth versus employment trade-off. There isn't one. Even the informal sector ultimately depends on growth and the demand coming back. You've got to open up as much of the economy as possible, which of course means that we have to take care of various health-related infrastructure as soon as possible, vaccination and all those kinds of things. And we've got to get the economy up and running. You know, there is no amount of schemes is going to you know, compensate for the fact if, say, the restaurants are not open, the hotels are not open, the airlines are not functioning at full tilt. And of course, people on, you know, colleges, hospitals, everything is not functioning at full tilt. Only then you can go back and looking at where the maybe the so-called trickle down is not happening, and then we can try and fix those areas. But we've got to get this economy up and running and going. Secondly, we've got to persist with supply side measures and continue to open out various sectors, which for a variety of reasons continue to be unnecessarily held down by government regulation. In the last 1 year, we have done a lot of these things. You saw opening up, for example, of the geospatial and cartography sector. You saw the removal of all kinds of outdated bureaucratic hurdles placed by telecom regulations on the BPO ITES sector, which we removed completely, and some more changes need to be done on that, and we are happy to do that. There may be completely new sectors, for example, like drones that need to be opened up further, and maybe completely new sectors we don't know about. But if there are sectors where outdated regulations are getting in the way of innovation and expansion, please let us know. We are very, very open to looking at them and rethinking it from scratch.
Right. So Sanjeev, I'll come to the reforms part in a minute, but just one question before that. See, last year you had mentioned on several forums that we need to keep the powder dry because we don't know how long the pandemic is going to be and what is the impact, right? While other countries like UK were doing large, at least they promised to do large quantity fiscal transfers, direct cash transfers. Some of it has not really worked even for them, as we know in the hindsight. But do you think a more loose fiscal policy is now the need of the hour?
So, the point about keeping the powder dry is that ultimately you're going to use it. So if the need requires, we should be willing, and we are willing to do it. The point when last year when we were in full lockdown, and the point I was making is there's no point in ramping up demand when the problem was a supply side shutdown. But once we did open up the supply side, we were not shy about using the ammunition to ramp up all kinds of spending on infrastructure. In particular, capital expenditure was genuinely ramped up, and all kinds of other payments and other things that have been, historically we have all these kinds of payments in our pipe, in the government pipeline, that are not paid. We sped those up and made sure there was liquidity in the system. And that did have an impact in accelerating the economy. We did announce a fairly aggressive spending plan in the budget in February, and most people were very pleased with that. Just because we had 2 months in April and May where things got disrupted doesn't mean that we still don't have that budget doesn't have to be implemented. We still have to implement it. So we need to get on with it and implement all those things that we said we will do. And we remain committed to doing all those things. I don't think anybody is coming back and saying that those things should not be done. I think those things remain valid. In fact, they are probably even more valid now that you need a boost. So whatever fiscal support this economy needs, we will provide it. And as I said, keeping the powder dry is only useful if you are willing to use it when it's necessary. And we are willing to use it when it's necessary.
Right. Okay, so Sanjeev, coming to the reforms bit, see, last year there was a series of announcements on the Atmanirbhar Bharat initiative and a whole host of opening up of sectors and loosening of regulations. But it appears that a lot of it is not yet implemented, right? So, or it's taking time to kind of get there. So how do you see that picture evolving? By what time do you think we can reap the full benefits of these reforms?
So it depends which ones you're talking about. Some of them have got implemented. For example, as I said, deregulation of the IT BPO sector, deregulation of the cartography sector, the introduction of bilateral netting. All these are, may not sound like grand measures to many people, but they're all step-by-step measures that make big difference when you add them all up. Similarly, things like labor laws have got it done. We introduced farm reforms, which we are committed to, They have been held in abeyance because of some political pushback, but we remain committed to it. And I think even there, we are demonstrating that the new system we have created in terms of direct transfers to the accounts of farmers, etc., that works. So that if there were suspicions that we were removing one system and not replacing with the other, not the case. The new system has been completely demonstrably been shown to work better. So all of this is getting done. We also continue to push through various government expenditure. For example, we continue to be pushing along on road building and so on. Even on the Central Vista project, the fact is that we continue to do it despite a lot of objections for aesthetic or other reasons, political reasons that may be there. We have continued to push ahead with them and make sure that those things get spent so that that cash flow goes through to the economy, the employment comes back. So those are the things we have continued with. Now, there are some things that need to be implemented going forward still. One of them will be privatization. And as I said, we are not shy of calling it privatization and not using euphemisms like disinvestment and so on. We are committed to privatizing those things that we do not consider to be strategic core, strategic areas. Now, there are certain things we will retain in the public sector, including, for example, a significant part of the banking system, because, some part of the banking system and the financial system does need to be in government control. That does not mean that we do not want to, go out and sell, for example, Air India. There is no reason for governments to be running hotels and airlines and that kind of thing. So even in areas where we intend to retain some government participation, even there, the level of government participation may get diluted down, maybe through privatization, but also by making it easier for the private sector to grow faster. So whatever way, the point is being made is that those reforms are in place. We continue to push for them and we continue to push for new ones. I mean, one new one that has come through, which is not a central government reform, but we are encouraging it in the states, but in my view has enormous importance, is the Tenancy Act. The Model Tenancy Act has been put through. I think it's a huge thing. You will be amazed the extent to which real estate lies tied up in India, which is not being used because people are not willing to rent out their real estate to people because they are too scared. My own view in this is that this Tenancy Act, if implemented, will mobilize huge amount of assets in the country and monetize them. So I think there are many things that we continue to do, and there are other things, if you bring it to our notice, we will certainly look at. The idea is to get the creative juices and the animal spirits of the private sector up and running.
Right. Sanjeev, two reforms, which if you can explain this better, because you were personally involved in these and they are quite high impact, but also probably not well appreciated. One on the IT BPO one, which you mentioned on how those regulations changed. And secondly, on the geospatial cartographic reforms. What is the real benefit to the economy for those two, if you can explain those?
Okay, so let me start with the second one. You see, people don't understand that cartography and geospatial sector is an extremely important sector at multiple ways. I mean, you use it every day, right? Google Maps, and then there are many, many other uses for it, from urban planning to, managing insurance for the agriculture sector, managing natural resources, forests and water bodies. There are millions of uses. And of course, then defense and other things. So there are a million different uses for cartography and geospatial data. But interestingly, this sector was essentially, for most part, a government monopoly till very, very recently, mostly under the Survey of India. So ironically, even though Google Maps is essentially an Indian invention, by the way, which is invented by the Google offices in India, but it was not done by Indian. It was done by Indians, but not for an Indian company, and then only rolled out in India almost as an afterthought, because we had all these restrictions. And in fact, till a few months ago, technically speaking, and legally speaking, the operation of Google Maps in India was essentially a gray zone legally, because, you know, it was basically, it got rolled out around the world, so we were also using it, but technically perhaps it was illegal. So why should that be the case? So in order to open this sector out and allow for innovation in India, and by the way, there are many new things which would be possible because you can build it on top of this. For example, large-scale deployment of civilian drones can only be done if you have already got the geospatial backbone. So all of this requires this sector to grow, and we have the capacities to do it clearly since we invented the biggest one, Google Maps. But this has to be done in India for Indian companies, Indian innovators. So we needed to open this up. So just a few months ago, we completely opened this up. Now this sector is basically entirely open. If there are areas where things are still being a problem, then we are willing to relook at the rules and change them. Same thinking was there, by the way, in the case of the IT BPO sector, where these were regulated by these very onerous telecom rules, including some 1980s ideas about, you know, where EPABX machines had to be placed and so on. These were completely outdated ideas in a world where we are all functioning on the cloud. I mean, how does it matter where the EPABX machine is or is not? You can have rules about where, you know, data is stored and all those kinds of things. That's fair enough. But why do you care about these kinds of things? So those rules, I think back in November, we opened them up. There are still some niggling issues relating, for example, about, you know, partitions between international and domestic BPOs and things like that. We intend to smoothen those out over time. But the point is, these kinds of regulations have become very, very onerous in India, and very often they create their own ecosystems in terms of regulation, in terms of lawyers and accountants and things. And then that ecosystem itself actually gets in the way of making opening things up. In the end, we have got to have the approach that we open these things up, let innovation happen. And very often misuses will also happen. It's okay. But, you know, if we start with the view that misuse will happen and therefore it should all be controlled, then, you know, no innovation is possible.
Yeah, right. And especially in the work from home era now with, the services economy also potentially can grow because the location doesn't become that much of a constraint. I think this could be quite significant, especially for the small companies with a few offices around the country and so on. So, Sanjeev, one last question on the larger economic picture. We have been talking about a 5 trillion economy. We had set a 5-year target. I think financial year 2025-26 was the target for the 5 trillion mark. How do you see that now with 2 years lost to pandemic, at least 1 year lost and the second year in transit? How do you see that picture evolving? Do we shift the date or do we shift the number, headline number that we are chasing?
I think $5 trillion economy is very doable for India. Sure, there have been some disruptions along the way and that may delay things a bit. But I don't think we'll be delayed as much as people fear. You have to remember that through all this disruption, we have continued to do huge changes in terms of reforms. New large capacities are getting built even as we speak. In completely new sectors, our export sector is still very competitive. And there are actually new ecosystems, for example, in the vaccine field, et cetera, that was already there, but now has become even more strengthened. So I think we are in not as bad a position as people make it out to be. Yes, there has been a disruption, but I think our capacity to bounce back is, not as bad as people think. We are quite a resilient economy, and our financial system, for example, is not anywhere near as disrupted as people think it is. Maybe because we simply weren't as leveraged as many other countries were going into this crisis. The banking system was already significantly being cleaned before we went into this crisis. So therefore, it was not so leveraged. So the So, you know, the pileup of NPAs has been much smaller than people had feared. And so our banking system, ironically, is full of cash and is actually capable of expanding as and when the situation, you know, the private sector comes back and begins to invest again. So I am quite confident that, you know, when that happens, we will be able to deal with it. Similarly, I think, you know, as I said, FDI continues to flow in. The key here is to get the health concerns out of the way as soon as possible so that we can throw the whole system open as fast as possible.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Sanjeev, so much for your time. This was very insightful and, you know, always great to hear you talk about a buoyant future for the Indian economy. Really appreciate your taking time out for Bharat Vartaa. Thank you.
Namaste.
Thanks.